Hello and welcome to recording number 30 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated recording. Today is July 10th, 2021. I'm going to restart here on page number 228, paragraph 4. As a little background, Gord has just been released from jail by Geller, who has come as a bit of a surprise. And as now, instead of the thief Geller from Stoink, he's representing himself as Lord Geller from Nyrond. They've been discussing Lord Blemmu and the Radicans and retaking the Bone March. There's a siege around Spine Castle. And currently Blemmu and the Radicans are expanding into the territory that was originally taken by the goblins and the orcs and other monsters. All right, to begin, there was more, but what struck Gord as most interesting was the distance between Nurl and the Nyrondal capital city, Rel Mord, which was more than 150 leagues, and the fact that they were separated by the wilderness of the Flinty Hills. Could Dunstan be flirting with ideas of independence for Blemmu, allying with the northern realm of Radic and playing off Rel Mord against Roxas might enable a clever noble to gain sovereignty? If indeed such thoughts were uppermost in the Count's mind, then he would be dreadfully concerned about the ramifications of Gord's imprisonment. Geller's discovery of the action and intelligence reaching King Archibald, all supposing that the once one-eyed man actually was the king's general, and that Gord was one of his august supremacy's most valuable agents. Gord knew, of course, that the latter was totally fallacious, but Lord Blemmu thought it the truth. If he indeed plotted to renounce his vow of fealty and seize independence, then he would most likely overreact to this minor situation, which would be to Gord's advantage. Interesting indeed. So, here we have a good reasoning then for why Blemmu would be very apologetic and overlook his anger with Gord, and Gord here being caught just attempting to escape, having made his way out of his cell. Now, in the Moor campaign specific, we have a definite geographic measure here. Nurl to Rel Mord is 150 leagues. We have the possibility of Blemmu doing what a number of states have done to the Great Kingdom and declared its independence. We have then Gord himself questioning, as I've questioned right here, is Geller really the Geller of the House of Geller? Now, the House of Geller is the County of Ernst and Duchy of Ernst. They're the ruling family there. Belisica, who is the Countess of the County of Ernst, and her brother is the Duke of Ernst. Geller saying that he is a Lord General among Nyrond, that really puts quite a different take on, who Geller is, and also it shows the link between the Geller families of Ernst, the House of Geller, and the Nyrond. I'd like to note that here there's also his august supremacy. It reminds me of the title given to Boss Daly in Stoink, and that these leaders seem to use some of the most ridiculous names for themselves here, as they, you know, as they call themselves, kind of this overblown reaction to their nobility. But it also kind of shows that Boss Daly is a despot, and here I think we also have where it's also where perhaps showing how powerful King Archibald is within Nyrond. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 229, paragraph 2. Eventually, the conversation waned to desultory remarks, as full belly and fine wine took blood from brain to stomach. It had grown late besides, and the evening was finally ended by the constable wishing all a good night's rest and cheerful morrow. As Gord and Geller made ready to leave, Sir Mellard came to them and assured the two that all would be in readiness for them at dawn, just as the Lord General had directed. It is most regrettable that the officers of His August Supremacy will be unable to remain a few days at the castle, Sir Mellard said without conviction, although the facilities will be strained to capacity with all the wedding guests, personages such as yourselves, representing the royal court, would be most welcome and all quartered for the event. Wedding guests? Queried Gord. Never mind that, Captain, said Geller quickly. I am tired, and we must be away on business of the king by first light. Come along, and I'll inform you of the happy event that Sir Mellard referred to as we go. You've been a bit out of touch, shall we say. Gord was unwilling to let the matter drop, for he did not quite trust Geller to give him the whole truth, and wished to get to the bottom of it by questioning the obsequious constable then and there. However, he recognized a firmness in Geller's urging, despite its friendly tone, and in the way his general turned abruptly and headed for the door, expecting Gord to follow. His wisdom told him that silence and patience were the wiser course, so he turned on his heel and also left the dining room swiftly, doing as he was ordered. Break. So there's, you know, right here we have that Geller is going to leave right away, and that there's mention of this wedding. And obviously, Geller is wanting to get Gord out of the castle as quickly as possible. And Gord himself is very kind of, maybe it's the time in the jail or his strong feelings for Evely, but he's very, he's not quite taking his cues or that discernment in the direction you might expect. You know, first, Gord was in prison for a long time, over a month, and he did not immediately try to escape, and he had this feeling, you know, he was going to let Evely try to, as she said, get him out of that jail cell, and it never occurred. So Gord's reactions here, they aren't his usual, self-survival that he had always had a good good reaction to seeing the situation, and he fled, fled the Beggars Union, when it was being taken over. He fled the City of Greyhawk when it looked like Arentel was going to come after him. Gord, he left the Rene when it looked like, there was more, when he needed to get away from Adaz and all that. So Gord has always been, pretty quick and, concerned with his survival, even over romantic attachments. When he left Greyhawk, there was a certain romantic difficulty going on. And here, just the opposite is happening, where Gord is, staying behind, holding himself back from, grabbing what he can and fleeing. All right. going to restart. And it is page 229. And it is the final paragraph. Keller refused to say anything at all on the matter, however, when they arrived at the small suite assigned to them. Using the thieves' cant and hand signs, Keller cautioned Gore to mind his tongue. The walls hid many things, including listeners. Once they were well away from the castle, said Keller in the secret tongue, he would tell Gore everything. Sorry, changing a page here. He would tell Gord everything he wished to know, but for tonight they must remain stolid officers of the King of Nyrond, here now merely to refresh themselves with a night's sleep before going on next day to carry out the secret affairs of his august supremacy. Grudgingly, Gord agreed, and soon both men were tucked in their beds, located in adjoining chambers behind unlocked doors. Gord, unused to anything softer than a bit of mildewed straw scattered on a stone floor, thought the softness of the bed would prevent slumber. He was quite mistaken, for sleep overtook him in a moment, and he barely stirred for the rest of the night. A restrained tapping on the door of his room brought Gord awake. This was followed by a rustling sound as somebody moved into the chamber. Gord opened his eyes, his muscles tense, his hand going instinctively to the dagger at his bedside, even as he turned to see who had intruded upon him. It was merely the fussy valet who had attended to him yesterday, now engrossed in his morning ministrations. It was still dark outside, and the servant carried a candle with him. He had deposited a stack of garments on a nearby stand, and was now in the process of setting flame to a half dozen tapers so as to illuminate the room. When the task was finished, he turned and saw Gord watching him. "Good morning, sir," said the servant. "It is nearly first light. I've come to assist you in dressing and preparing for your departure." Gord harrumphed, but swung his legs out of bed and arose as the valet fussed with the stack of garments, separating things and laying them out. Gord washed and otherwise went through his unaccustomed morning ritual. In the meantime, the fancy clothing he had been given to wear yesterday, and which he had tossed casually aside when retiring, had been picked up, brushed, and painstakingly folded and stowed in a small leather pack, evidently for Gord to take along when he departed. The valet handed him new linen, then insisted on helping Gord dress. The apparel he had been given today was designed for rougher activity. Heavy stockings, short breeches of leather, with a like doublet worn over the linen blouse. This ensemble was all in black, and completed with high riding boots, gloves, soft cap and cloak. Another set of small clothes was packed away, as Gord broke his fast with fresh bread, cheese, salty sour galled fruit, and watered wine. The valet hastened to hand him a napkin as soon as it was evident that he was through, and then whisked away the remains of the meal, leaving Gord alone in the room, and wondering what would happen next. He went to his weapons and began buckling the short sword to his waist, when another rap sounded on his bedroom door, and this one much more impatient sounding than the servant's taps. Break. Here we have a little description of how Gord is being treated as a, suspected noble, at least of a lower order of nobility, but still a noble. And if Blamu is worried about him being an agent of the King of Nyrond, then he's making sure to treat him very well, supplying clothes, supplying traveling clothes, and everything ready for him to go, which Blemu should be happy with. I'd like to note here that here is another mention of the Galda fruit, and we're told that it's salty soured. Galda fruit is one of the Greyhawk unique items, and it was mentioned originally back on page 17 in recording one, I believe. At the time when I'd been indexing this, I hadn't really noted it down as anything special. And while it's not a magic item or anything such as that, it is a unique item, unique fruit from the Galda tree that is Greyhawk setting rather than, real world Earth setting fruit or item. And here we have a little bit more information about it. It's just a little taste of flavor that adds to the campaign. And it's those kind of things, if a DM can bring them out, that it enriches the campaign in general. It's not something that most players would object to, that extra little bit of detail. And I find it can, spark the interest of players and even kind of throw them off sometimes, where a casual mention can sometimes be an important clue. And if you put it in with other casual mentions, you can have them guessing as to what is a clue and what is not a clue.
Yeah, it sounds good. I mean, I would like to try one.
Yeah, salty sour. I can't really think, but what fruit is salty sour?
I don't think there are many.
Yeah, not on our Earth here. And otherwise, right here, we just have a bit of storyline that is going. Mostly, the continuance of this plot that where Gord is escaping from Blue Moon Castle before anything worse can happen. Geller really seems to, want to move on from there. Because he knows things that I just suspect. What I suspect, and honestly can't remember, is that Evelyn must be getting married, is my suspicion from that the talk of a wedding that Geller does not want mentioned.
Yeah, he wants to get Gord out of there as soon as possible so there's no international incident or something like that.
Yes, because Gord is really not acting. I try to emphasize that Gord is not acting like himself. Again, this is examples of the subtlety and subterfuge and disguise that is a really common theme throughout the story. It's really not everybody's Greyhawk campaign, but the Gord story here really does show how maybe it's just a thief campaign, the way that he felt thieves would act on their own. But there is so much here about disguise and subterfuge that, you don't normally get in a fantasy novel where, you usually have magicians and, young warriors, young magicians that start things out. And there may be some hidden information, but not normally all this cons and disguises and the very quick reactions of the characters like Gord and Geller when the mercenaries from the Hierophants of the Horn Society were recruiting, and they Gord instantly came up with a background, and they conned their way into the tent where the shack where the mercenaries had their gold hidden.
It sounds a lot, well, maybe not a lot, but a little like that game that Aronson was playing when Gygax met him. I forget what it's called, but it was European political intrigue.
Diplomacy?
No, it wasn't diplomacy. It was one of the precursors to D&D and Chainmail, even.
All right, yeah, that one I can't remember. I do know a little bit of that early indie history time, but it just doesn't strike me, you know. But they were, you know, big war gamers and everything.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think I'm gonna start again right here, on page 231, and it is paragraph 2. Ord called for the entrance of the one so knocking, and in came Sir Mellard, followed by a churl bearing several bundles. The constable ordered him to place his burdens gently on the bed, dismissed the fellow, and then spoke to Gord. Busy affairs of the coming celebration again prevent my master, Count Blamut, from personally attending to your wishes ere you depart. He has sent me personally to see that all is satisfactory, however, and I am at your disposal. At the last portion of his speech, the constable appeared pained indeed. He managed to go on, though with only a slight grimace and a swallow. Humblest apologies are given you for having detained you in so unkind a fashion. Had you but mentioned your service to his august supremacy, but no matter. I'm instructed to personally crave your pardon, and humbly beg your forgiveness for my part in the misunderstanding. Sir Mellard paused expectantly. Get on with it, man, Gord ordered him, allowing his pent-up anger and general dislike for the fellow to permeate his tone. The constable winced and nearly flew into a fury himself at the outrage of a mere soldier speaking to him in such a manner, but then he recalled his mission, the instructions of his lord, and the supposed station of Gord as captain and agent of the King of Nyron's personal corps. Composing himself again, Sir Mellard resumed his speech. Lord Blemmow, in his generosity, and to emphasize the depth of his regrets, bestows upon you the following gifts. The constable paused here and turned to the packages, lifting them one by one as he talked. First, here is a purse of coins to assist you comfortably on your return to Rel Mord. Next, this blade, the constable continued, unwrapping and holding forth in near formal presentation a beautifully crafted small sword, as a prize captured from a brigand chieftain from the northern border. It is wrought from an alloy of steel and adamantite, I'm told, and then enchanted so as to pierce dragon's scale or foeman's plate without losing any of its point or edge. Last, but by no means least, my Lord Count gifts you with this silver neck chain, a piece taken from his personal coffer, and set with garnets highly polished to enhance its beauty. Sir Mellard held it out toward Gord. See, it bears the arms of Count Blamut himself as its chiefmost decoration. It will show that you have his noble favor. Break. You know, that is quite the reward there. You know, of course, now that Gord is dealing with, you know, a baron, or is he called a count here? I thought he was baron. No, he called a count. And I believe earlier, Evely was referred to as baroness. So I'm not sure in my rankings, but I believe Count may be higher up in most nobility than baron, but I don't know my, you know, fantasy social ranks quite well enough to say offhand. You know, quite an interesting take there. I mean, the coins are the coins, but be given a blade that can pierce dragon scale or plate armor. It's very similar to his dagger, though. You know, his dagger is also capable of pointing, but, you know, piercing unenchanted. We also get a description of what the blade is made of, steel mixed with adamantite and then enchanted. So that is quite a reward right there in and of itself. I'm a little distrustful of what the neck chain might actually be. I don't know why. It might just be a memory of what I've read. But it seems, you know, the silver neck chain, I find a little suspicious. It may be nothing. It just may be my own thoughts on it, that I don't entirely trust Blamu here. Now, we also have, again, and I'm very glad that, you know, Gygax reacted to it, had Lord Sir Mellard react to this, is that Gord being very rough with Sir Mellard here, and the Constable Mellard's instant reaction to this low level, you know, low social level individual, a soldier, coming out and speaking to him in such a rough way. So, you know, I would expect in the story for that to happen. So, you know, I'm generally pleased how Gygax really, he really thought this through, you know, I mean, and he thought it in a way that, for the most part, I find, you know, he does really take, like, if something seems a little out of order, it usually is that there's very quickly a show of what he was thinking, and, you know, just showing that Gord's reaction to being angry is immediately, you know, replied to, where this Sir Mellard's instinctive reaction is to come out against that. Oh, yes, yes. And I, you know, here we have, you know, Chris is bringing up on the Grey Art Fiction, you know, text channel here, that there's a game that both Gygax and Arnonson played before the beginning of Chainmail, was called Bronstein by David Wesley. And it was played between the two big cities, and a very big influence on D&D. And as Chris was just saying, there is a similarity between that and the kind of things that are happening, you know, here within the reaction between Blamu and the representatives of King Archibald, and the amount of perhaps backstabbing, as Gord suspects from Blamu, and of this the way the actions of various fantasy nations and leaders, and among each other, and that even, you know, Blamu, who is, Archibald is the liege of Blamu, and yet there appears to be, you know, this idea that maybe Blamu is playing against his own liege lord.
And you were right, too. Bronstein does draw a lot of inspiration from diplomacy.
Yes, and I think the big thing was it kind of, as Gygax added the magical element to Bronstein's game and made Chainmail, Bronstein was adding a wargaming element, you know, to diplomacy, where diplomacy had only it had indicators, but it wasn't a battle game, and it certainly wasn't played with miniatures. So, yeah, you know, there, that shows really that Gord is moving again. You know, in this stage, you know, Gord in Stoink is, by those actions, is raised up. And from here, now he's in Nurl. And again, he is being shown, although he isn't like a main royal himself and a higher member of the social class, he is being moved up into that, you know, general atmosphere, that circle, where even though Blamu won't meet with him, Blamu is definitely, you know, he's having Mellard apologize. You know, very, you know, that is, you know, quite a thing. And it shows that how concerned he is about how representatives of Archibald, the king of Nyrond, is being treated. It really shows, and like the gift of this short sword, this enchanted short sword, it really shows how Gord really has reached a different stage in his character here. I really think we're seeing, as they mentioned earlier, Gord, at this point in the story, we're about two-thirds through the book, that Gord has really, really moved up, and we're in a different stage.
Now, both of his weapons are magical?
Yes, short sword and dagger. Nice. And according to the old rules, I believe you can backstab with either of them. Depending on things, the magical short sword should be even more devastating a weapon. And the magic of both is similar in that it seems they mostly involve removing the effects of armor. And since this short sword is said to be able to pierce dragon's hide, I don't know if that would be considered magical armor, where his long-toothed dagger is not supposed to be able to pierce magical armor. It cuts through regular metal, but unenchanted. All right, I'm going to restart right here. And it is page number 232, paragraph 3. "Is that all?" Gord asked icily. All, sputtered the constable. "You so dare as to..." Then he again recalled his mission, took one deep breath, forcing a smile to his lips and calmness into his tone, and then said, "There is one more thing which comes from his lordship. May I speak freely as gentleman to a gentleman?" "May, sir," Gord allowed graciously. "In the matter of your stay here, need it be emphasized in your report to the king? Lord Blemmu has been most generous in making amends, and he is concerned that his august supremacy might mistake overzealousness for some darker motive." At that moment, Geller came in from his adjoining chamber. Gord immediately suspected that he had overheard the conversation, and was timing his entrance accordingly. "It is not a matter worth any further consideration or note," Geller boomed in a hearty voice. "Be a good fellow and tell your good count just that." General Geller and Captain Gord understand the whole affair was an error, and who amongst us errs not? It is a trivial thing of history, best forgotten. He said reassuringly as he guided the constable to the door, "But do relate to his lordship that his generosity will long be recalled whenever Blumu Castle comes to mind." Beaming, Sir Mellard departed, assuring the two that they would have the swiftest and finest of coursers, with appropriate trappings, awaiting upon their departure. Then hurried away, and Gord looked at Geller to see if he could determine what the fellow was up to. Geller was dressed in much the same fashion as Gord was, with a belt bearing long sword and dagger girding his loins. Gord noted that he too had a fat purse and wore a long neck chain. Geller's chain was of golden links and rondelles and bore three deep blue sapphires, each flanked by a pair of smaller diamonds. Gord opened his mouth to utter a comment about rank bribery, but his companion stifled it by the waving of a finger at him and winking with the eye that should not have been there. Gord thought the gesture was growing more than a bit tiresome. "Let us be off, Captain Gord," said Geller with vigor. "We have far to go, and much to speak of as we ride." All right, break. This is page 233 and the end of chapter 22. Now, mostly this shows how Gord really seems very thrown. Now, Gord could act angry, and I think in this case, it really isn't so much acting as that Gord is angry and he is not in the state of mind to allow himself to hide that anger at all, even though it really is inappropriate if he wants to get out of there. You know, I'm a little surprised that Geller isn't keeping a tighter rein on Gord, especially because he's worried about, I think, Gord finding out information about this wedding. I was also surprised that it mentions Geller has a mount, as I'd have thought he would have had his own mount for getting to Nurl in the first place. But, you know, who can tell? One of the things that would happen often is that distance riders would change their horses. And, you know, especially Geller supposedly just got there, and he may have to abandon the horse he was riding. You know, it's not something I think most people would prefer, because their horses, you know, they get attached to their horses. They know their horses. Each horse is an individual and can react differently. But in this case, for some reason, Geller seems to be, you know, getting a new mount. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page number 234, the beginning of chapter 23, and the first paragraph. True to the constable's promise, a pair of magnificent war horses awaited Gord and Geller in the outer bailey of Castle Blamu. Saddled and readied, each black stallion held by a liveried groom. These were not the huge and muscled destriers of cavaliers and fully armored men, but the leaner and smaller mounts favored by those who desired swiftness and endurance. Saddlebags of provisions were topped by the leather cases containing the finery each of them had worn the past evening. As Gord was mounting, a small page scurried out of the great hall and ran to stand at his stirrup. "Pardon, sir, but my mistress, Lady Evely, made me fetch you this on your departure," the page said, and he held up a small casket of engraved and embellished silver for Gord's taking. "Where is your mistress?" Gord demanded, accepting the box but not bothering to look at its contents. "Oh, sir, she went off to his lordship the Count's villa in Nurl yesterday it was. But before she and her ladies departed, she told me most sternly to see that I deliver this to you," the lad said, pointing at the silver coffer. "Very well, it is delivered." Gord nodded toward the boy, tossed him a copper hastily dug from his purse, and wheeled his horse to follow Geller, who was already heading for the gate. Two of them passed through the gate in single file, and Gord held a position slightly behind Geller as their mounts trotted out onto the road. He wanted a bit of privacy while he examined Evely's gift, and Geller seemed to understand this. The box was quite pretty and valuable. Gord thought that even being in used condition as it was, it would bring an orb or more in some fine shop. It was old and had been crafted in a form Gord had never seen before. It took him a couple of minutes to find which petals and carven flowers to press and move to release its catch and allow the lid to slide back. The coffer was lined with velvet material of a deep violet hue, which surrounded a small scroll and something wrapped in silk embroidered with sigils. Gord dropped the reins and took out the scroll. His mount slowed to a walk as his eyes took in what was written thereupon. "My dearest Gord, I shall always bear your memory in my heart, just as I shall always remember our time of love together. If troubles surround me, all I need do is recall your sweet face and brave deeds, and my world brightens. Ours was a love which could not be. Forgive my weakness, I implore. Understand my father's ill-advised ire. Think of me fondly, with tenderness and affection, now and then as you rise to fortune, As for me, I shall make the best of what sad and cruel fate mets out. I pray for your happiness and safety always. Send my dearest of thoughts with you, my champion, always Evelie. These words, soft as they were, did nothing to dilute the bitterness in Gord's heart. In fact, he reacted in quite the opposite way, and found himself thinking of Evelie as a liar and a bitch as he roughly thrust the scroll back into the box and picked up the parcel of silk. In its folds was the little necklace of silver links with a milky amulet depending from them, Evelie's dearest possession, Diomard pendant given her by her elven great-great-grandmother. So, you know, here we have, you know, Evelie writing to Gord. It shows perhaps that Evelie's weak character, you know, resulted in her first encouraging Gord and then just abandoning him. You know, she is giving away this pendant, which supposedly will prevent anyone locating Gord magically. And it is revealed that it was her elven ancestor, her great-great-grandmother, who gave it to her, and showing that Evelie actually does have elven heritage. Which, again, I think it's important emphasizing that the marks of that heritage are platinum blonde hair and violet eyes, which are the descriptions of you know, the drow. So it sounds like, and Gord recognized it, so it sounds like some form of elves on the surface have that platinum blonde hair and velvet eyes, which, you know, which makes an interesting link to the drow.
And also explains a little bit about when or why she, definitely why she found that passage.
Yes, yes. I mean, that is, yeah, back then, the ability of elves to detect secret passages is why she found something that Gord thought he himself would have had a hard time discovering. There's some mention of this puzzle box. You know, it's interesting to hear how it is described. It's something that you can take from this book and drop into your game. And think about, you know, there's times when a treasure is in a, you know, in a rough bag, or in a plain chest, or, but also there should be times when even the container of the treasure itself is a treasure in it, you know, treasure itself. So, you know, here we have this valuable puzzle box being given to Gord to hold things. Now, this is two necklaces that Gord now has from the two silver. It's amusing that he again was a little angry to see Gellar get a better necklace than he got, and that it was seen as a bribe, which it was. I mean, all in this given by Lord Blemo is an out-and-out bribe for, you know, Gellar and Gord not to bring up what was going on with Gord's imprisonment. And of course, the worry there is that that Blemu might be thought to have known that Gord was a spy for Archibald and imprisoned him for that, rather imprisoning him at the outrage of Gord and Evelie.
Yeah, it sounds like it's pretty much hush money, all the gifts that they're throwing at him. And it makes me wonder, would Evelie have done anything if Gord remained in prison, if it wasn't revealed that, you know, he was this agent for the King of Nyrond, for Archibald?
My feeling in the context is that Evelie would not have done anything, as she didn't, you know. And what's worse is she, for a month, either thought that she could do it and stopped without word, or that she never even intended to do it and just gave false hope to Gord. They really show her as having a, you know, a weak character here. I mean, because you'd think at the very least she would tell Gord that she couldn't help him. All right. Oh, did you have something?
No, that was it.
All right. I am going to restart here. It is page 235 and the final paragraph. This gift had an entirely different effect on Gord from the way he had felt just after reading the scroll. His attitude toward Everly softening with every passing heartbeat. He fastened the chain round his neck and tucked the amulet under the stiff leather padding of his doublet. Then, instead of hurling the missive she had written to him away in a crumpled ball, as he had originally thought to do, Gord flattened it and tucked it into a small inner pocket of the same garment. After placing... pardon me one sec. After placing the silver box within a saddlebag, he spurred his stallion so as to get even with Geller's mount, trying his best to put Everly out of his mind for the moment. He had much to learn from his traveling companion, and it was high time to start doing just that. Gord's saturnine expression, the lugubrious spirits, were soon uplifted by Geller's tale. He admitted to Gord that while he was indeed a member of Stoink's Guild of Thieves, and a well-respected member of that and other bandit communities as well, he had other identities. As Geller admitted, he did on occasion serve Archibald as an agent and spy. However, his liege was not the King of Nyrond by any means, but rather his cousin Belisica, her noble brilliancy, Sovereign Countess of Ernst. In fact, Geller said laughingly, he even performed favors for his more distant cousin, Carl, most lordly grace of Duchy of Ernst. Break. I think it should be noted that there seems to be a discontinuity right there. If Belisica is his cousin, and the Duke, as mentioned earlier, is his brother, then the Duke would not be a more distant cousin, unless they're referring to geographical distance from where they are now, as the Duchy of Ernst is south of the County of Ernst. I believe it may just be west of it. No, I think it's south. I unfortunately don't have some of the map of the Flaness really to mind all the time. And it isn't an area where I did much running of games or adventuring.
What now, are we talking about? The distance of Lukesh versus...
Well, because Gord refers to Duke Carl of the Duchy of Ernst as a more distant cousin.
Oh, and right.
I would think that means that he's not as close a cousin, like he might be a second or third cousin rather than a first cousin. But the Duke is the brother of Belisica, so Geller would be first cousins with him as well as Belisica. And I'm thinking that maybe he's referring to a geographic distance between where he is and. But you know, I think I believe it might be just a bit of a continuity error here in the story, that Gygax may have. You know, that was a couple hundred pages, or 150 or so pages ago.
Yeah, well, Lukesh is definitely south and west of Radagast City.
All right. Because it's around the edge of the Near Dev. Mm-hmm. And it's where Gord came to first with Rene, and then went up to Radagast City and the County of Ernst. And here Geller explains... not only his, you know, blood ties, but also the various things that he is a spy, and that he is, he is a spy, and he does play many different roles, which is again that while Gord is mainly a thief, Geller seems to be mainly a spy. And we have that business where, you know, some forms of spies are definitely aided at having thieving skills. All right. I've got to restart. It is page number 236, and it is paragraph 3. All this left Gord speechless. Gord observed his dumbfounded visage, roared with mirth, winked his newly grown eye, and laughed still more at the perturbed reaction this gesture got from his companion. "I must begin where we parted company," said Geller, as his chuckling subsided, and he wiped tears of laughter from his eyes. "Then you will understand better what has transpired." Thief and noble then began a tale that enthralled Gord so thoroughly that he failed to notice that Geller was leading the way from Nurl toward the ferry to the west bank of the Harp River. All right, break. So I want to point here that I'm pretty sure at Felsham it's listed as a shallow crossing. But here, west of the immediately west of Nurl, that there's also a ferry across the river. Or no, maybe Felsham wasn't the crossing point, was it? And I just read this. I'm trying to remember what the crossing point was across the river. Then they find Felsham. They turn to the east, because they're going south. They turn to the left, and that's east. And they come to Nurl. And yet there is a ferry, and that might be what is shown on Anna's map, that small, that town or city of Ivkin, I believe it's something like that.
There's a city, Nivlek.
Nivlek, that's it.
But the bridge was up the river a bit. And there wasn't really a town there.
All right. And then there's the ferry as well, which has no name, a town named associated with it.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to restart here. It is page 236 and the final paragraph. He related how the sovereigns of Nyrond and other allied and friendly states spent much in human and monetary resources to be apprised of the plots and politics of their unfriendly and hostile neighbors. The bandit kingdoms, as these sovereigns called the lands of the freelords, were of particular interest, but then no more so than the doings of the Hierarchs of the Horn Society, the dealings of Ten and the Theocrat of the Pale, Iridian schemes, whether those of the Overking or the Malachite throne of Roxas, and so forth. Although Evely's capture and the subsequent ransom demanded from Boss Daly were not great matters as far as statecraft went, King Archibald desired intelligence on what followed these events, for he suspected that his vassal, Count Dunstan of Blimu, was overweening an ambition. The question was, would the Count send forth to Stoink the ransom required for his daughter's return? The sum being demanded was so great as to pauperize the Count, and so it was thought, and it was well known that he was no doting parent. All right, so we again, it's interesting noting the societies that are considered unfriendly and hostile neighbors. The Bandit Kingdoms, the Horn Society, sure. But then Ten and Pale, as well as the Overking and the Malachite Throne, they are considered unfriendly. Definitely you can see it, the Overking and the Great Kingdom. But also the Pale and Ten are considered two unfriendly neighbors of Nyrond. And that is interesting to me. I hadn't read a lot about the second edition versions of of the setting, and perhaps it's there in Sargent's work where he talks about Niron being in conflict with the Pale and the Ten. But here, this is something a bit new to me. Now, the final thing again is dealing with coinage. I mean, there is the stuff about how the story is progressing, that Count Blemmo is not, overweening parent about his daughter and doesn't seem like he was going to pay her ransom, but that the ransom would pauperize. It was 10,000 golden orbs, and that would pauperize the Count Blemmo. And that itself seems, I don't know, it does show that how valuable gold is, that how often, in play, in regular AD&D, that 10,000 gold is, it's a substantial amount, but it is certainly not the fortune of an entire state, even a smaller one such as, Blamu and the Bone March. So it does show that that amount of gold, just 10,000 golden orbs, is a king's ransom or Evely's ransom. It's just and enough to beggar, Blimu. That just really astounds me, how valuable that the gold actually is in Gygax's version of the Greyhawk setting. All right. Let's see. Now, it also shows that the link between Archibald and his, and his servant, well, not servant, but his, he's the sovereign of Blamu, and yet he himself is unconcerned about Evely's capture. That's not outrageous, I think, but it is. It does show that there is not a great relationship between Blamu and Archibald, and probably not a familial one either, where they're not, it doesn't seem like they're related to each other. All right, I am going to restart briefly here.
I found something about the relationship between the Countess of Ernst and the Duke, I guess, in the duchy. I think they're cousins, not brother and sister.
Really? I thought the earlier...
It says it in chapter 12 in the first paragraph.
It says they're cousins. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
I'll post it.
I thought she said it was her brother. No, I'm wrong then. Yes. And Gygax is definitely not, there's not some discontinuity here then. That's just me. I don't know why I thought she said it was her brother. Makes more sense that he would be a cousin. It's interesting that the Geller family then holds both the county and the Duchy of Ernst. That's very interesting that it's within the house of the house of Geller.
Right. So I mean, more than likely they're also related to royalty in Niron.
Yeah, I mean that seems like it's likely. I'm not definitely not the Geller household though. I'm pretty sure Archibald, is not related to in that way.
Not directly, no.
Not within the same house, but the House of Geller may be a cadet family to whatever Archibald is, one of a family that is just a member that is perhaps linked to a marriage and not a male line of descent, I don't know how much that is used in the setting. I mean, obviously, here's the Countess, and she's leader of its own political state, and here is her cousin, a male, who's leader of his own political state. So at least in the county of Ernst, they practice Salic descent, which is descent through the which is descent through the female line, as well as the, you know, as well as the male line. So, you know, which is a big thing in Henry V and why Henry V is claims rulership over France is that he has a link through one of his female ancestors to the crown of France. And so we have that practice here. And it doesn't seem that there are that many women who are leading countries in the Greyhawk setting. So it may not be very common outside of some particular areas that have the you know the Salic bloodline going. But you would expect it more in the Greyhawk setting where individuals have such power. You know, unlike history, where our earthly real world history and an individual may have wealth, it may have they may have command, but they don't have this power in that they're incredible, you know, heroic warriors, or that they're magic users, or that they're, you know, in clerics who are high priests with their deity, and you know, so with the Greyhawk and the AD&D setting. You have it where an individual can be, you know, extremely powerful. You know, like Emrakul the mage, who is going down the streets of the city of Greyhawk, just blasting people and showing his individual strength. You know that you know it's something way above what you would normally find.
That's a great picture.
It is. I love that picture. And the general idea of that Emrakul, the chaotic, and just blasting people, you know, looks like for the sake of blasting them. I am going to end here. It is 7:02. I'm going to end here for the night. It is page 237. So, you know, hopefully I'll get to add the page numbers to the recordings and make it easier to look up specific topics. Right, I'm going to summon up Craig here, our handy-dandy recording bot, and leave the recording.